and then we'll sit until 8:30. So I think what I'm talking about tonight is that old Buddhist and Zen chestnut, the self. So let's see how that goes. I wanted to start with something from my day job, just quickly, kind of from the realm of critical theory. So there was a psychoanalyst, Jacques Lacan, who was busy revising Freud and being structuralist and post-structuralist about all that. And he was apparently pretty influenced by Buddhism, just as a little side note. So as a psychoanalyst, you ought to meet all your patients for 45 minutes or whatever it is. And he had what was called the short session. So he would just say at a certain point, you know, we're done for today. And it could be like 4 minutes in or something, which is kind of like in the old days, the Roshi ringing his bell at the end of an interview. And one of the things that he did is he got in some arguments with ego psychologists, American ego psychologists, who were really interested in Americans having stronger and more vigorous egos. And as against that, he really had a very strong sense of the self as not non-existent, but very definitely as a kind of function or precipitate of other things, of other kind of structures, both human and otherwise. And so you couldn't be a self if you hadn't been made one by this structure, which sounds a lot like interdependence or emptiness for sure. And so one of the things he's talking in one place about, he's very influenced by structural anthropology and kinship systems. And so he got interested in how, in order to be a speaking member of a group, you first had to have been almost kind of completely brought into being and structured by your place in that group. And so he's talking about tribal societies with kinship groups and so on, where actually your place in the kinship structure is actually scarified on your body, so that your whole body, in a sense, is sort of structured by this symbology of the group. And since he's French, he's going to say the subject, because it sounds fancier instead of the self, but he's talking about self pretty much. So he says, before any formation of the subject, of a subject who thinks, the level at which there is counting. So you get to be a self, you get to think, you get to walk around, you know, counting. So you count numbers, you could say yes, no, good, bad, green, yellow, right, wrong, and all those good things. He says there is prior to that, the fact that things are counted. And in this counting, he who counts is already included as somebody who's counted, right? It is only later that the subject has to recognize himself as he who counts. So there's this dramatic sense that you get to be one who can sort of act in the game, one who can play a part, one who can count, only after, in a profound sense, you've already been sort of placed someplace where you are counted. So you're really, the ability to be the self who can do the counting or can do the speaking really arises from being a function of this large structure. One of the things that's interesting about both structural anthropology and structural linguistics is they say that for somebody in those groups, you actually cannot cognize the whole structure. So, you know, you can speak English, but if I ask you at any moment, give me the entire set of rules that's governing your ability to say what you say, you can't generate it. And if you ask somebody in a traditional tribe, tell me all the, you know, combinatories and rules that determine who you can marry and who you can't and why you're wearing on your body what you're wearing, you can't do that either. So you really arise as a function of this kind of gigantic thing. Just do one more Lacan thing and then stop with him. There's a moment, he was busy retranslating Freud and thinking that the translators of the so-called standard edition into English had not done it very well. And there's a passage in Freud at the end of an essay on the psychical personality where he says, and so he's talking about the id, which is another name for the unconscious in his system. He says, Freud's, as he's translated, he says, there where id was, let ego be, right? So out of the sense of the unknown, let's have this triumphant sense of the self. And then he says, it's an endless task, like the draining of the Zuider Zee. You know, so this is a draining of this sea in Holland. And so the idea would be that, yes, on the one hand, the unconscious is vast, but as he's translated, the project is for the self really to kind of colonize or take over that territory. And so Lacan reads that, and it sounds a little too much, you know, a champion of the ego. And of course, he's translated into English when I'm reading him, but the way he translated it is he says, there where it was, I would like it to be understood. It is my duty that I should come to being. And it's just a little different, because again, there's a self or there's an I that's coming to being, and it's coming in the place where it was. But there's more of a sense that it is my duty to occupy and to know that I occupy that place of the it, of that vast thing that's not me, and to know that it's my duty to know that that's where I come to being as exactly a function of all those things. So I think coming to being means both, you know, I have to recognize that that's how I come to being, I have to realize that I'm called by being or by this vastness, and I have to realize it's my duty to know that that's what a self is. A self is the thing that rises up out of that vastness. Okay, so that begins to sound, I hope, at least a little bit like some of our projects. We could also say, if we wanted to, you know, there where mu is, it's my duty that I should come to being. There where no is, it's my duty that I should come to being. And it's a really different sense of what it is to be a self, maybe, than we're sometimes used to. So in Zen, we don't spend all of our time talking about kinship systems and cultural structures, but I think we have a great sense that if everything's interdependent, if everything is empty of self-nature, that everything rises up out of countless kinds of structures that exceed us and of which we're a function. One of the things I didn't grab in my haste to get here not too late was Joan's book about the sutra that Vimalakirti spoke. And I'll bring it in tomorrow and read you the whole passage. But there's a beautiful passage on pretending where she says that in this sutra, Vimalakirti, and we'll talk about him some other time, but he's a wise layman and a great teacher in this sutra, Vimalakirti is pretending to be sick. And so Joan says, well, that seems kind of shabby, you know, that he would sort of fake being sick. So she wonders a little bit about what pretending is and gets interested in the way in which sort of to be any particular thing that swirls up out of the vastness is in some bigger sense really to pretend that you are that for a moment and then you're not that. And part of our sense is that in that way we're kind of pretending to be the people that we are. And then she looks out the window and she says, you know, I wonder if all those subatomic particles out there are pretending to be trees. And I'll read you the whole passage because it's really lovely. But again, there's that sense that in some way, everything is what it is for a moment or a while, that in some sense, it's pretending in the sense that it won't always be that, that it's a function of all the things that let it be what it is, and that after a while, as Joan used to say of retreat, you know, which swirls into and out of existence, that that thing that the trees pretend, that the atoms are pretending to be, or that we're pretending to be, will swirl out of existence also. So lately, I've been working my way through a book on the beginnings of Yogacara Buddhism in the 4th and 5th century CE by working on a book by Ben Connolly called, it's got a wonderful expose title, it says Inside Vasubandhu's 30 Verses, which is great. And then our great friend and teacher Norman Fisher gave a series of talks on it that I've been listening to. And I want to say just a little bit about that. So this is in a way more detailed than you need for a second, but both Ben Connolly and Norman place Vasubandhu at this kind of cusp where Theravadan Buddhism, and in particular the scholars of the Abhidharma, is sort of morphing into Mahayana Buddhism and the sort of emptiness philosophy, and that Vasubandhu is in some way trying to reconcile those two things. And this will be a very bald kind of summary, and I'm not an expert in this by any means, but as both Ben Connolly and Norman tell it, the stress in the Abhidharma is on paying incredibly close attention to your own sensations, to what's called the six senses. So it would be the sort of ordinary five senses, and then the mind, which is taken in that system to be another sense whose object is thoughts or internal phenomena. And in the Abhidharma, the focus is on paying attention as minutely as possible to those sensations as they come and go, partly, and this would have something to do with studying the precepts, for kind of psychological reasons, so you know your own inner states and you're aware of them and you can begin to work on them, but also apparently to understand that as you track those sensations, there isn't anything that you could call a self that's having those sensations. So for some of you, that would remind you of Nietzsche, right, saying, you know, when I say I think, that the I is extra, so we say it thinks. But so one of the functions of the Abhidharma was to give you a sense that there was no self. So as I understand it, Vasubandhu kind of picks that up and begins to kind of sprinkle a little Mahayana emptiness philosophy into it. And one of the things that arises from that is that while psychologically it's extremely important to pay attention to the variety of our sensations and emotions, from another point of view, they're all empty too. They're all just coming into existence and swirling away. And so to get too fixated on them is actually to miss the possibility of seeing, oops, you know, the bottom drops out and everything is evanescent, coming up out of this vastness. The other thing that he says, which is pretty great, is he says, well, actually, you know, there is this persistent sense of having a self, and that, you know, it's kind of odd to think that the sensations are real and we have to beat the crap out of the sense of self until it disappears, because in a way the sense of self is no more empty than the sensations. So this is the system in which the seventh level of consciousness is manus, or the self. And what he seems to be saying, as I understand it, is that if you're a person, you're going to have a sense of self. And this is very close to some of Joan's teachings, some of you will know. And so if you spend all your time trying to wring its neck, you know, it's probably a project that won't end well. And in a way, why not just say, oh, I have a sense of self, so that's okay. You know, it's no worse than having eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, you know, so why not let that be okay? One of the things that he says in Norman's take on it, and I'll try to unpack this a little bit in a second, is that in some way the self is a metaphor. So the self is, it's a metaphor in the sense that it's a collection of various things that we agree to call by one name and regard as an entity. It's also a metaphor, I think, is in that once we're inside a sense of self, there's certain other things about how we see the world. We say the world, I guess Norman would say, is like that, but on some level it isn't really that. So we're kind of interested in the way in which to have a self is to occupy a sense of the world that's not exactly the way the world is, but that's a kind of a way we have of processing it or categorizing it or understanding it that can be understood as not ultimately real, but a kind of metaphor. And so one of the things that Norman says and attributes to Vasubandhu as well is, you know, if you know it's a metaphor in some way, that's okay. Then you live inside the metaphor. If you try to spend all your time getting out of the metaphor, it'll end up being self-defeating. And on the other hand, if you insist that it's not a metaphor, that's a problem too. So there's a sense of wanting to take the sense of self kind of lightly. One of the things that Vasubandhu focuses on, and this will take us back to some of our talks from the spring retreat, is that as soon as you're inside that metaphor of self, there's already a sense of a subject, an I over here, and the world out there. So there's already this kind of fundamental dualism between the self over here and everything else out there. One of the things that seems to follow from that is that it's pretty hard to not imagine the self in some way as always persisting. And in some way, though, I mean, this is not entirely the case, as some way always being a constant that underlies everything else. So it's kind of the fixed point against which, you know, against which all other things are encountered. And then, you know, as we've also talked about, and as everybody knows, once you're doing that, it's you over here and the things over there. And once there's this initial kind of dualism, the next step is to begin kind of categorizing things and also to think that the categories are real. And again, I think the project would be not to get out of categories, but to realize in some way that they're things that you've made. They don't describe reality as it really is. And so you hold them really, really lightly. All right. I should mention also a little digression, but that since Norman's a poet also, I remember his saying that he was delighted that another poet came to one of his Zen talks and was delighted that he was talking about the poet Wallace Stevens. So I'll mention one thing that Stevens says. Stevens talks about the necessity to believe in a fiction which we know to be a fiction. And that's really the kind of process I think that Vasubandhu is talking about here. Okay. So I think one of the ways to deal with this metaphor is to have a sense that the strength of it kind of comes and goes. And so a lot of the time, you know, it really seems like we are a self, we have a self, that's what's organizing all experience. And there are other moments where that seems to sort of fray or shred or fall away. And I think if we allow those moments, then we can really see it for the metaphor it is and not get caught up in it so in such a dire way. And if that's true as well, then if we experience the moments where it's kind of gone or it falls away and something else comes into view for us, or we come into view for something else, then I think we don't need to regret the moments when it comes back. One of the things about Lacan that's pretty interesting is that after saying, well, you know, the self is just a function of everything else, he and, you know, the ego psychologists have it wrong. In some sense, he had a gigantic ego. You know, he's very kind of full of the joy of being Lacan. And those of you who've met Roshis will have a kind of similar sense, I think, often, that they have a very profound sense of no self, or of the level in which they're not a self, but they don't become faceless at all. You know, they're very much themselves and very individual. And one of the things I love that Norman says someplace is he's talking about the beat poet Philip Whalen, who became a Zen teacher and was really strange and wonderful and cranky. And Norman said, I was always worried about becoming a Zen teacher, I would sort of lose my personality, you know, and just be. And then he said, I took one look at Philip and knew that that wasn't a danger at all, you know. So there is, if you can let the self go, you can kind of let it come back and say, you know, yippee, what a great metaphor we're living in today, all right? So I want to turn now to a sense of awakening and what that has to do with what I've been talking about. You know, what happens when we have a kensho of some kind, when we experience the emptiness of our own nature? It's sometimes talked about it as an enlightenment experience, which may be, you know, a name that has too many capital letters in it away and, you know, makes it too monumental. But I think for sure, you know, well, in the tradition, there are some accounts that make awakening look like, and I think this is not right, you know, and there's some pretty good books that suggest it's not right, that make awakening look like, you know, now I've torn through the veil of illusion and I'm seeing reality just as it is, you know. So that would be pretty great in a way if it were possible. But note also that in some way it's the subject-object dualism, you know, jacked up on steroids. Do you know what I mean? So not only am I the knowing subject kind of seeing everything as if through my binoculars, but now I got really good binoculars and I'm really seeing it exactly the way it is and I got it, you know. So that's not necessarily the kind of moment that you want to have. I think a truer account really is that something instead happens to your sense of who you are. Something happens to the sense of self. And I think it's as if in a way, at least in my experience of it, that feeling that I'm over here and I'm relating and walking around to the world and kind of triaging it, what happens is it's like you slip on a banana peel in some way, you fall into it. You know, you're not over there and it's not over here, but something typically will come and fetch you. You know, it can be any one of a variety of things that's right there. And then you get a sense that in some way you're no different from it. You know, if it's a plastic window tassel, you probably don't think you're exactly a window tassel, but you might think, oh my God, I'm no different from it, you know. And there can be a moment where you see, if it's a light tassel, you see it sort of blowing in the breeze, you know, coming into the zendo, and it's light enough that there's a kind of buoyancy to it, so the air is, you know, the string is kind of holding it up, but the air is holding it up a little, so it's, and then you can feel your own body that way, you know, I'm no different from that, the air is holding me up, I'm another thing in this field. And then you can have a moment where it seems really funny that you're about to eat an egg because you're a thing and the egg's another thing and you're all just, you know, kind of in it together. So I think it's really an altered sense of kind of where you are in relation to things, that you're in the midst of them, you're a function of them, they're holding you, they're sustaining you. It's really comic, you know, why should that be true, you know? And it's really full of joy. I remember an important thing that Joan said to me. I was talking about, you know, trying to sort of go through the gate, and I said, well, I know, you know, you don't have to give up being a self forever, you know, so it's kind of like I'm going through airport security, I'm going to check Tenny at airport security for a while, but then at the end of the flight I sort of get it back, you know. And she said, well, no, it's more like the universe is being Tenny now, you know, which is really beautiful. So it's like you get to be who you are, and it's something the universe is being, just like it's being the window tassel, just like it's being the air, just like it's being anything else. There's a really, well, how to get here. There's a dog book. There's a dog training by a book by a guy named William Keeler, who was much enamored by Vicky Hearn, who is a dog trainer and a horse trainer, who was also a Wittgensteinian philosopher, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, there's a moment where Keeler talks about one of the ultimate stages in dog training, and I never got close to that with any of my dogs. But it's the moment where the dog will do something that's called standing for examination. There's something really moving about it. And so the deal is, like, if the dog is really well trained, you have the dog stand in this group of other dogs and other people who are training their dogs. And I don't even know what the name of the command is anymore. But you tell the dog to stand for examination, and the dog will come up there and just let strangers touch it. You know, the stranger, just complete strangers can come up, touch it all over, and it's just open to that. And I really feel, in a way, that that's a great metaphor for moments of awakening, that you're willing to stand for imagination. You know, the universe, the world is kind of touching you all over, and you let it do that. And so a sense of, you know, what that kind of openness to things might be as a sense of the self having sort of fallen away or falling into the field rather than being the knower of the field, I think is really, really important. I'll come back to this later, but one thing I think that happens is pretty clearly, as we're saying, you know, a sense of self will kind of reconvene or re-solidify. But, and this is one of the functions of Cohen work and talking with a teacher, you don't really lose that experience completely when it's gone at all. So that becomes part of, in an odd way, sort of what the self knows, and it changes the self sense of itself. So I wanted to talk about one or two other ways in which I think in our practice the self is really part of a field or a function of other stuff, to go back to kind of Lacan's sense of it. One of those things would be, I think, pretty clearly, if you meditate a long weekend like this or at a retreat, kind of odd things start swimming into your consciousness that normally are not there, and you really don't exactly know where they come from, why they got there. Sometimes they're distressing, sometimes they're fine, often they're just kind of dreamy and odd. And if you do that for a while, I think you really have a sense, you know, which Freud or Lacan would have been quite comfortable with, I think, that the self that you know yourself to be is just one part of the story. And in many senses, again, it's a function of, or it's part of a confederation with, a lot of stuff that it doesn't control or can't master. And so I think that sense of sort of the coming and going of narration, the falling away of narration and experience, sort of moving more towards sensation and so on, things that are not so much narrated according to the lifeline of the self, is another way in which that sense of self begins to sort of fade in and out in a way that, when it comes back, reminds us that it's not the whole story or the only game in town. One of the things I think that happens in particular, I'm going to use a Freudian terminology for a second, is that the bar between consciousness and what he would call the preconscious kind of gets lowered. And so the idea there is that what we're aware of is just this tiny percentage of the stuff that comes into our sensorium in the course of a day. And the traditional Buddhist metaphor for that is it's the eighth level of consciousness, and it's called the storehouse consciousness or the Alaya Vijnana. And so it's stuff that hasn't really entered into consciousness and been sort of brought into the stories and projects of the self, but just this gigantic array of sense memory that's in there someplace. And it will tend to loosen the sense of self because it's not really attached to any story. And if you meditate for a long time, you can often have these long periods where there's just kind of this, Philip Whalen called his poetry a continuous nerve movie. And he was interested really in just, in a way, this sort of array of sensations. In his poetry, it also meant chit-chat and conscious thoughts. But I think when we're sitting on the cushion, often there really is just this kind of stream of sense memory, and it doesn't have much logic to it. You can stay in one place for quite a while. You can kind of decide to go back there. And then something else will come into view, and who knows why. And so there's this tremendous sense, really, that's what's inside you is really just a myriad of memories that are not tied up with your stories of self, not tied up with your projects, and to some extent on this kind of subliminal or dreamy level, to go back to Joan's sense of things pretending to be trees, they really are who you are. And another thing, so one of the things that means is that as you turn your attention inside, the stuff inside suggests, oh, the self isn't the whole story. But it's also suggesting that the inside is really made up of the outside anyway. I mean, what goes through your mind is these sense memories of trees and rocks and dogs and sky and cars and all those things. And so really there is no self that's, you know, not all, all tied up with those various things. So as I guess I said already, I think that one of the things that happens in practice, and maybe especially in koans, I know it's probably not fair to say that, is that the self increasingly learns, because as soon as you go into a teacher, as soon as you talk to yourself and you say, oh, I had this experience and this is what it was like, that's the interpreter, that's the self doing some talking, you know. So if you think that's a problem, you better throttle it, right? And Cohen's then will say, no, tell me about it, you know, so let's do that. And I think that what can happen is that after a while, the self becomes a story of better story, becomes a teller of better stories. And the self can begin to tell stories where it's not at the center, where the things that it's a function of actually begin in a kind of conscious way to shape and condition its sense of who it is and how it acts. One of the places I am not yet, but one of the places I've encountered something like this for sure, being around other Zen people, is Freud says that you can't dream your own death, you know, so that the self can't really imagine coming, going out of existence. And I had a couple of dreams where I was about to lose the self and, you know, it wasn't there. And I think I mentioned this at the spring retreat, and I was in a room with, you know, three or four people that, that Bill and I knew from a long time ago. And they said, of course you can dream your own death. It happens all the time, you know. So that sense of the self as fungible, you know, as variable, and again, as a function of everything else, in various ways will arise in practice. So I think koan work is also especially useful for this, in that it's probably not true that what's happening in koan work, and we've said this before, is that, you know, the mind is completely being, you know, blocked by something illogical, and so you go into the space of no mind. But I think what happens is, in a way, koans are stories that come from the land in which you stand for examination, you know, the land in which you're a function of the world outside you, the land in which sense memories swim into view, sort of out of no place, the land in which time and the timeless seem to intersect. And so koans are one way in which we can begin to sort of move ourselves into this more fluid sense of the self, you know, sort of strengthening and loosening without wanting to eradicate it or without having a sense of panic about it. And just to end by linking it to some stuff that we've been talking about in the hobby horse that I'm riding lately, I think that one of the cool things koans do is they propose a kind of pidgin English to us. They'll often say things, or our work with koans will often say things in a way that sort of doesn't seem to make sense, or it seems like whoever said this, you know, wasn't speaking the language quite right. And in that strangeness, it begins again to loosen something or to kind of change the perspective on things. So as I've been saying lately, I'm especially interested recently in the practice that John Tarrant began talking about a while ago, many years ago actually, where if you're working with a koan, everything you meet is that koan, and so you kind of walk around trying to test that out. So if you walk around and you're working on the koan, the storehouse of treasures opens by itself. You can take them and use them any way you want. If you walk around and you sort of say, well, how is this the storehouse of treasures? How is this the storehouse of treasures? That's kind of strange. If you're working on what's the sound of one hand, and you walk around like you go to a rock concert or something, and you say, well, how's this the sound of one hand? Or you're in a train station, how's this the sound of one hand? It gets a little odd. And lately I've been interested in bringing that into play in relation to the precepts. And I think one of the things that will do is it will bring the precepts into range of the kinds of experiences of the vastness that I've been talking about, and create a pretty interesting interaction between sort of daily ethical questions and cruxes and that sense of the vastness. So if you walk around and you ask, how is this I vow not to steal? It's pretty strange. I mean, you can translate that into, how are the trees not stealing, and how can I learn to be as good as the trees are? Or, you know, how are the trees telling me that I'd be a bad guy if I stole? You know, but if you just walk around with the strangeness of, how is this I vow not to steal? I think, again, it will sort of begin to swim you into some of that terrain. And the latest field report that I'll close with, we're working in the next 2 weeks on I vow not to misuse sex. And I thought, this one is not going to work so well. This is going to be too strange, you know. So just today I started working on that, and I'll tell you, it's great. It's really strange and wonderful to walk around looking at the rocks and the trees and say, how is this I vow not to misuse sex, you know. And it actually, there's something there for sure that will change your sense maybe of the rocks and the trees and also of sex, which is probably a good thing. All right, so that's it. Let's take a couple minutes for any conversation that we might want to have about this, and then let's go back to darkness and sitting fairly soon. So also, if there is no conversation, that's fine too. Either way is good. So.
Well, I just wanted to say about the what I was thinking of, or what was coming to me when you were talking earlier was the Genjo koan. You know,
yeah.
It was just it was kind of making it stand out for me.
Okay.
You know, but I was wondering what your thoughts were on the kind of sloughing off of things that seem to not work for you or don't appeal to you.
Like, what do you mean?
Okay. Habits and stuff.
Uh-huh.
As part of that, you know, what you were referring to as the coming to you.
That seems right. You know, yeah. I think in a way that's a device also, that if you sort of see habitual things coming up,
mm-hmm.
and you realize maybe, oh, actually I could let that go for a while,
mm-hmm.
that's beginning to kind of, you know, sort of rub at the sense of the self and its boundaries.
Right.
Yeah. Sort of a collection of defenses and procedures. Yeah. Yeah, James.
I was thinking about the koan from the miscellaneous koans, the one that says things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise, and how that seemed to relate to what you were saying about how, you know, something like is what it is, but then it's sort of, in some sense, it's not. You know, the subatomic particles are like pretending to be a tree, but in a sense, they're just particles.
Yeah.
You know?
And in another sense, they're a tree, right? But both things. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I think that's in the spirit of the Jung quotation that I'll bring in tomorrow. Yeah.
And when you see the tree, though, like it's very definitely a tree.
Yeah.
And it's very definitely not subatomic particles within the world of what we know.
Yeah.
Like if you touch it, it's solid.
Yeah.
You know, whereas you would think if it's mostly empty space that your hand should pass.
Yeah, that's great.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you're Harry Potter, it would.
Yeah. So the moment where you say, you know, yo, James is pretty real, you know, that's fine, right? You know, and the project is not to get rid of that. Anything else? All right, so thank you. Let's walk again, I think, and then let's sit our way to 8:30.